It's Thursday, May 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams reporting from Washington. Coming up, the Islamic State captures the city of Palmyra.
What's happening in the region is tragic, and I think if you look at what ISIS has done in past situations, they tend to focus on the larger targets.
Britain may assess its participation in the European Union. California battles a drought, and a blind boy defines his life through music. It's all ahead. The Islamic State group is now in control of the famed Roman-era ruins of the ancient city of Palmyra, hours after seizing the Syrian town from government forces, according to a monitoring group. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the Islamic militants took over the 2,000-year-old UNESCO World Heritage Site late Wednesday. Mark Vlasic is a professor at Georgetown University, and he's counselor for the Antiquities Coalition. He tells VOA's Jeffrey Young about the operation by the militants to seize antiquities.
First of all, thank you so much for having me and for raising this important issue. What's happening in the region is tragic. And I think if you look at what ISIS has done in past situations, they tend to focus on the larger targets, blow those up for effect, for propaganda value, and things that are smaller, that are movable, they tend to take out and try to sell on the black market to raise money for the terrorist operations. And so I think it's a bit of propaganda value, using the smokescreen of that destruction to basically cover what they're also trying to do, which is raise money for their operations in the region.
What is in Palmyra that is able to be packed up and crated off and sold on the black market? Mostly I see huge buildings. What else is there?
So like most archaeological sites, you have a combination between the large structures that you see in pictures, and things that people would actually like to have in their homes or their gardens. And I think that's the challenge for many of these locations, that there are things that, you know, obviously are not going to be moved out of the area. And frankly, if they were, they're so noticeable that if they ever went to the marketplace, people would know where they came from. There'll be other antiquities that are either placed at one of the museums that are there, or placed underground, where they can dig these things up and bring them into the black market. And that's, I think, the big concern is antiquities that no one knows about, that are underground now, that are being, could be excavated for these individuals and put in some marketplace, because there's no way of tracking what you don't know exists.
In previous conversations that I've had with you, you've told me that the Islamic State has essentially issued franchises for excavation teams if they pay a tithe or a chunk of their proceeds to the Islamic State. The IS allows people to come in and dig. Do you think that's going to be the situation in Palmyra?
I think what's happened is there's a professor at Swanee State University who's done a lot of research on this, and what he's noticed is the fact that the ISIS is obviously a complex business organization, and they tend to focus when they can on their core competency, which is terror, and they outsource, you know, the looting itself to folks that are professionals in digging the stuff out of the ground. And I think what you see is a division of labor, where if they're going to have fighters, they're going to be focusing on the fighting side, and they can bring others in to, you know, basically profit from the looting of the materials, and at the same time, ISIS profits from it as well.
The things that are above ground at Palmyra are known, they're cataloged, they're registered, so to speak. You brought up the underground artifacts that no one has ever seen yet. The things that are above ground, if they're known and they're cataloged and everybody in the antiquities world knows about them, where is there a market for these things? How can they be sold if they're so well known?
So I think that for many of the pieces that are, you know, the things that are not to be moved, those are the ones, if you look at past situations, why are getting destroyed and blown up? Because there's very little market for them. To the extent there's pieces, that there's been a couple cases of archaeological sites in Syria and Iraq that have been looted, which have already been kind of investigated by archaeologists and others and cataloged. Those are probably situations where there might be individuals that have a personal interest in one of those, two of those pieces, that have actually asked or they have a relationship. There's been some reporting by some other reporting groups in the world. We've talked about the fact that there's, at times, there could be a personal relationship between individuals who are doing the looting and actually high-end buyers. this is a interesting marketplace and ones where people are able to take advantage of the chaos that's going on at the moment.
That's Mark Vlasic, professor at Georgetown University. He was speaking with VOA's Jeffrey Young. Well, joining me here in the studio is Michael Lippin. Michael, what's been the reaction on social media to this seizure by ISIS of Palmyra?
Thanks, Sarah. Well, I can tell you that the top story right now on our website is about that topic, and it's by our Middle East correspondent, Jamie Detmer. It's headlined, IS, or Islamic State, poised to seize huge Syrian arms depot. And that's a arms depot in the Palmyra area. Among the comments at the bottom of that article are two from readers in New York. One by the name of Derek says, "What many fail to understand is that ISIS, that's another name for the Islamic State group, is an apocalyptic religious cult. It believes that all ISIS martyrs will go to heaven. Their goal is to destroy the world eventually. The world should unite to destroy ISIS." That's from Derek. And this comment comes from Bernie Goetz. "Dictators are needed to control the bad elements in Arab countries, which are not ready for democracy. The people were much better off with Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad. The Middle East is now a disaster, and there's no telling what will happen in the future. Congrats to Bush and Obama." It's a bit of sarcasm there from reader Bernie Goetz. Feel free to share your thoughts on the situation in Palmyra as well. You can leave them at the comments box at the bottom of the article page. Sarah?
Thank you very much. That's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. An anti-European party won nearly 13% of the vote in this month's British election, putting pressure on newly re-elected Prime Minister David Cameron to deliver on his promise to negotiate a better deal with the EU. He's promised an in-or-out referendum by the end of 2017. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
Prime Minister Cameron wants to keep Britain in the EU, but many Britons want out, including some in his own party. He needs to get concessions from his continental counterparts, and that may not be easy.
The UK wants basically a special deal.
Thomas Raines at London's Chatham House says some European countries will be reluctant to make concessions to Britain, but he notes at least one major factor balancing that.
It's pretty clear that nearly all the other countries in the EU want to keep the UK in.
Britain has one of the largest economies in the European Union and is an important voice for free trade. But it does not use the euro currency or participate in the Open Borders Agreement. And its people are increasingly resentful of what many see as the high cost, overregulation, and excessive immigration that EU membership entails. Speaking via Skype, Christopher Howarth of the Open Europe Research Organization said to get new terms, Mr. Cameron will have to work with other EU members, not against them.
The best way to get the best possible deal is to make allies in the European Union, make common cause with other states who also want to reform the European Union, and there are a number of them, and pitch the ideas as not UK-specific ideas, but ideas that would help the entire of the European Union.
Thomas Raines says Britain may find some unexpected allies for EU-wide reforms.
I would expect that David Cameron will try quite hard to build a coalition, probably centered around Germany. So if he can build a coalition which is supportive of some of these aims, then he has a chance of being successful.
Many analysts believe Mr. Cameron will get enough to satisfy enough of his countrymen and keep Britain in the European Union.
It might not be everything that everyone in his party or the electorate at large wants, but I think the chances of getting something are quite significant.
The process has already started.
We come here with a very clear mandate to improve Britain's relationship with the rest of the EU.
On his first visit to Brussels since the election, Britain's lead negotiator, Finance Chief George Osborne, warned he will be resolute and firm, and there are indications he will try to move quickly to end the uncertainty and hold the referendum next year. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams.
Here are the latest headlines. Islamic State insurgents overran the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra and its historic Roman-era ruins Thursday, leaving the militants in control of half of Syria. The takeover immediately threatened the 2,000-year-old UNESCO World Heritage Site with its towering colonnades and other ruins and priceless artifacts. A senior U.S. diplomatic official is headed to Myanmar, where he will call for improved treatment of the country's Rohingya minority. It comes a day after Washington signaled it's willing to help provide refuge for the thousands of members of the ethnic group stranded at sea. Around 3,000 refugees and migrants, mostly Rohingya from Myanmar and Bangladesh, have been rescued or swam ashore in the Southeast Asian countries over the past 10 days. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has told the nation that upcoming elections will take place in peace and insisted that the recent unrest in the capital is not representative of the rest of the country. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Coming up, we meet a remarkable young musician who happens to be blind. The drought in California is moving into its fourth year. While the state governor is mandating a reduction in urban water use, most of the water used in California is for agriculture. But city dwellers and farmers are feeling the impact of the drought. Some experts say the state's water system was not created to handle long periods of drought. Elizabeth Lee reports from Ventura County, an agricultural region just northwest of Los Angeles.
We're picking the largest of the fruit.
The drought in California worries almost every farmer in the state, including Ventura County avocado grower Ed McFadden.
It's a big concern, and a lot of us are losing sleep. If you look around here, you can see trees that have been here for decades.
John Christ with the Farm Bureau of Ventura County says what happens to the crops in California has impacts that extend far outside the state.
Well, we grow half the nation's fresh fruits and vegetables.
Christ says the drought has become a hardship for many farmers in the state.
Agriculture already had been cut back. There were almost no deliveries from the state and federal projects last year, and 500,000 acres was left fallow. That's a real impact.
State and federal agencies control the water used by many of the farms in California. That water comes from places such as Northern California and the Colorado River.
I would say the system for capturing, storing, and transporting water in California that we have, which, you know, a lot of the big stuff dates back to the 50s, 60s, was great at the time given what was known. But obviously we live in a different world than we did then.
The water system has depended on melted snowpack as the water source and was not engineered for long periods without precipitation, says Stephanie Pincel of the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at University of California, Los Angeles.
In the 20th century, there was more rainfall than historically, and so we engineered these systems to manage that, and we did not anticipate the kind of growth in agriculture or in populations, or climate change.
Change that means warmer, drier weather.
I think it is inevitable. You know, we need to look at different ways of storing water.
Pincel suggests looking at California's groundwater basins.
We really need to use what we have in the ground, and those groundwater basins, to create what they call conjunctive water management, surface and groundwater together.
Ed McFadden says, unlike many other agricultural regions in the state, farms in Ventura County depend almost entirely on groundwater. He is doing better than his counterparts in other counties.
So far, we've been doing pretty well. We've got a good crop that we're picking this year.
But the water table is approaching historic lows. Farmers here say it is critical to carefully and fairly manage the water they have, a necessity for all farmers in the state, regardless of where their water comes from. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Ventura County, California.
This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
If you have a car, lower oil prices means cheaper gas. In the U.S., you now save $10 on a 13-gallon tank from a year ago. But for countries relying heavily on oil exports, the drop means lost revenue. During the 2008 global financial crisis, Africa was spared major damage, mostly because of its underdeveloped financial markets. But today, the continent's a victim of plunging oil prices. Nigeria and Angola are the largest oil-producing countries, and oil companies there will now have to consider if they want to move ahead with billion-dollar projects that need higher oil prices to make a profit. And while most consumers enjoy the lower prices at the pump, social safety nets in less diversified economies are at risk. Less money for HIV prevention, for example, less buying power for imported goods, and loss of revenue for governments fighting extremist groups like Boko Haram. What's an economy to do? Economists say become more diversified. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
Here in the United States, Cole Moran was born blind. He also has cognitive delays and other birth defects. He has to learn everything by ear. Nevertheless, the 12-year-old has had an insatiable love for music since he was born. VOA's June So introduces us to the young, phenomenal harmonica player.
You ready?
Yeah.
All right, here we go, buddy.
Cole and his father often play together at home. But this wasn't something Frankie Moran could imagine when Cole was born.
When he was born, I didn't see any eyes like how we have eyes. And my heart sank. Oh, wow, this is real now. He's blind. So we danced on the street corner.
The singer-songwriter says his son always gravitated towards wherever he was playing around the house and touched the instruments. When Cole was about 1 year old, he started picking out notes of the songs on a toy piano.
And that's about the same time we discovered he had perfect pitch, because when he would miss a note and hit the wrong note in, you know, a melody like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, he would go back and find that note. So that's how we figured he knew what he was hearing.
Cole's choice of instrument since he was four has been the harmonica.
But it wasn't until he was about six or seven that he started just hearing songs and being able to play them right back as soon as he would hear them.
Cole has early onset scoliosis that requires him to undergo surgery every 6 to 9 months until his body fully grows. He's had five surgeries over the past 3 years. Except for the first few weeks of the recovery, he practices every day, recording and listening back to the sound.
Happy. When I play music, I am happy.
Last year, the father and son duo won second place at an annual Fiddler's Convention in their hometown, Berlin, Maryland. Now and then, Cole performs with his father under the name Blind Wind at a cafe in Berlin.
It was awesome and so inspiring.
Thank you.
And he's become a bit of a celebrity there. His first CD has recently been released.
It's amazing. Since he was a baby, it's always been his thing. And now it's wonderful that he has something that he can do for the rest of his life that he'll always enjoy.
I don't think there's any limit to where he can end up. And I'm talking, you know, mostly musically, on the music side. I think he's got a really bright future.
When Cole finishes school, Moran says they plan to hit the road and take Blind Wind on a tour around the country. For producer June So,
I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Berlin, Maryland.
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks very much for joining us.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.